Mark Crotty, and Hub Arkish on 670 The Score.
Kind of the general sense of the organization is I think everyone's optimistic about our future. I think we've put ourselves in terrific position, but I think everyone's disappointed that in the way the season played out. I think we showed at times for long stretches that we're a really good team, but ultimately, like, it's pretty binary. We're not playing today. I'm having a press conference today. And I think that, you know, from Tom on down, I think there's a level of disappointment in that. And so, of course, there's frustration. I think there should be frustration when you fall short of a goal that you set a year ago.
That is Cubs general manager Jed Hoyer. Tom is Tom Ricketts, the owner of the Chicago Cubs, from whom you will hear in just a second, or at least his words, as spoken by me, Mark Grody. We've got Hub Arkish here as well, as the Cubs are trying to figure it out. The Cubs coming off a 83-79 season in the first year of Craig Counsell, and Hub and I were just talking about this, that David Ross got the Cubs to the exact same record last year, so back-to-back seasons in which the Cubs finished at 83-79. Each season is a different story, so it was different the way David Ross got to 83-79 and relative to the way Craig Counsell got to 83-79. And it should also be noted, too, that in this era, and I don't know, maybe we're in a different era right now, the era that started in 2015 where you had sustained success getting to the NLCS three straight years, and oh, there was a World Series title in the middle of that, but for 4 years in a row, the Chicago Cubs have not made it to the playoffs. They have not been to the playoffs since the pandemic-shortened season of 2020, and even in that year, they were swept in the best of three. It lost two games at Wrigley Field to the damn Miami Marlins at the time. So even that year, which was a very, you know, there's a lot of excuses with the pandemic and all that stuff, but even when they got in 2020, it did not look good. So something is amiss with the Cubs. You did bring in this manager, Craig Counsell. We were just talking about Craig Counsell as well, Hub, and you said, you know, I'll share your words off the air, where, you know, we're not going to go in on the guy after 1 year, but I will say that a manager who is making $9 million a year and who they did unceremoniously fire David Ross to bring in, I supported it. It was harsh, but I kind of liked it because it was like, okay, this is the real, the Cubs are gone. This is what the Cubs do now. It's a different era of Cubs baseball. It's not warm and cuddly anymore. It's cutthroat because it's about winning. But 83-79 back-to-back years and no playoffs for four straight years is not about winning.
You know, I think when you look at Craig Counsell's record and David Ross's record, it's obvious Counsell is a better manager. That was a big upgrade. And the fact that Ricketts made him the highest paid manager in baseball, that's what the Cubs should be doing if they want to contend. They've got to start spending more money. They've got to be a big market team. They've got to spend. So it's not a Counsell issue. I don't think it's that at all. But what upset me so much about, you know, fortunately, Ryan sent us the letter, and I read the whole thing, is I don't know if the Ricketts family really gets this, because he apparently, with his letter, thought all he had to do was tell his fans that he understood that they weren't good enough and that he was upset as they were. And that was all that was in the letter. He didn't say a word about what they were going to do to get better. He didn't make a commitment to spending more money. He didn't make a commitment to free agency. He didn't say, I don't care what it costs to keep Cody Bellinger. Say anything about how you're going to make this team better by acknowledging what a disappointment the season was. And you didn't tell us anything. You didn't say a word. And I got angry after I read that. You know, I've been a Cubs ticket holder for years and years, and I'm a nut about it. I don't, you know, expect any team to win every year. You do expect most teams to win a little more than the Cubs have won over the last 100 years. But at the end of the day, I just wanted the owner to come out and say, you're all right. I'm on the same page as you. I've got to spend some more money. We've got to be a big market team. We got to go do this. And, you know, he's not going to tell us who they're going to compete for in free agency. I don't expect that. But he should have said, we are going to be players in free agency. That's the minimum he could have said. We're going to be players in free agency this year. But he didn't say a word about it. Nothing. And you know, he did manage to mention their farm system.
Yes.
All he did was mention it. And by the way, that's exciting. They have 8 of the top 100 prospects in Major League Baseball. That is more than any other team in Major League Baseball right now. And so, yeah, I'm excited about the farm system too. But we also know that none of those eight prospects may be great players once, you know, once it comes time for them to become something in the NFL. So I thought Ricketts had a chance to really make his fan base happy by giving them some hint that he was committed to doing more this year. It sounded to me like he may have been committed to doing less. He didn't commit to doing anything more. He just said, I'm sorry, we're not good enough.
It's almost like the fan base has kept the bar high and the Cubs have let the bar slip a little bit. Let me do this for everybody listening right now. The letter that Hub is talking about, I'm going to read it in full to you. This is a full letter from Tom Ricketts, the owner of the Chicago Cubs, to Cubs fans. And here it is. Cubs fans, there is no way to sugarcoat it. This is not where we plan to finish the season. Like our fans, we had high expectations for our team this year, and early victories delivered hope for postseason baseball. But inconsistent play and injuries upended that promise, leading us into a hole too deep to recover from despite another second-half surge. Bottom line, we did not play a complete season of competitive baseball. As a result, we have again missed the most exciting and exhilarating month of the season, October. The work is underway to close the gap to make the Cubs a perennial playoff team. Our baseball operations staff is rebounding, or I should say redoubling, its efforts to build a team that consistently plays in the postseason and delivers the promise of sustained success to Cubs fans. Though we fell short this season, we have strong foundations to build on. Again, this is a letter from Tom Ricketts to the fans. A few more graphs here. Jed Carter and our team of coaches, analysts, scouts, and strategists have created one of the top player development groups in the game today with eight prospects, as Hub said, with eight prospects on MLB Pipeline's top 100, the most of any team in Major League Baseball. After this summer's draft, the Cubs boast a top-flight player development system in the most independent ranking, or I should say, in most independent rankings, including number two in USA Today's latest evaluations. Under the leadership of manager Craig Counsell, we continue to see players develop on the major league level. Rookie pitcher Shota Imanaga, who signed as a free agent last offseason, had one of the best seasons as a rookie pitcher in Cubs history, leading the team with 15 wins, a 2.91 ERA, 174 strikeouts, and only 28 walks. He steered the way on a memorable September night in Wrigley Field, where his seven hitless innings kicked off a combined no-hitter that was closed out by Nate Pearson and Porter Hodge. Rookie Michael Busch secured a starting role at first base. His slugged 21 homers, 775 OPS. Fellow rookie Pete Crow Armstrong, sick, brought excitement to the base paths with six triples and a 93% stolen base rate. PCA also kept runs off the board with his electrifying defense. Additionally, veteran Ian Happ had a career year with personal bests in home runs, 25, RBIs 86, and continues to be a clubhouse leader. Just about there, folks. Before we turn the page on this season, I also want to thank you for helping us recognize Ryan Sandberg this year. For many of us, Rhino's play defined an era, and his statue unveiling was a once-in-a-lifetime tribute to true Cubs legends and the legend himself. Ryan and Margaret are forever a part of our Cubs family, and it was important for us to stand in support of his fight against cancer by hosting Cubs for a Cure this year, absolutely, which helped raise $1 million to battle this terrible disease. We also want to remain committed to making a positive impact in the community through Cubs Charities. This year, more than 17,000 students participated in our youth, sports, and academic programs in neighborhoods across Chicago. It is these special moments and activities on and off the field that bring the players and fans together to remind us of what we all love about Cubs baseball. It is more than a game. It is a tradition that spans decades with our fans at its heart and soul. You bring an excitement to the ballpark that is as time-honored as the ivy-lined walls and historic scoreboard. I want to personally express my sincere gratitude for your continued loyalty to our team. Now it is time for us to get to work to bring championship-caliber baseball back to Wrigley Field. Sincerely, Tom Ricketts. Spot on with those last several graphs, by the way. Ryan Sandberg stuff and the fan and, like, good. That's awesome. What I get out of that, Hub, though, like what I glean from it, if I have to give you a headline to it, Tom Ricketts is saying, hey, we did this once where we had all these great players come up in the year 2015, and we won a World Series. We didn't have to go. I mean, we had to sign a guy here or there. We had to go out and get a Jason Hayward or bring in a Dexter Fowler from the outside. But we had all we grew Chris Bryant and Javier Baez and Anthony Rizzo.
Let the kids have their fun.
And Schwarber, like all the, like. So I understand. Like I think that's his reference point because he's talking about all these young guys. And maybe they're going to be that, but I think he is telling you, or at least this is what I'm getting out of it, that don't expect the Cubs to go crazy in spending because they think that they could do it again and win from within, which is a great idea. I mean, or in theory, I mean, I love the idea of it being your own guys, but you're not going to strike like everything went right with all of those players. And I know they're all gone now, and we can go down that road if we want as well, but each and every one of those players that came up, even the ones like Starling Castro, I know that was a Jim Hendry guy, even Addison Russell, like all these guys, they all play, like you got the best out of those guys in that 3-year span, which rarely happens. We're kind of seeing it with Baltimore, but they were an early dismissal from the playoffs this year. So that's what I get out of it, Hub.
I thought where that letter went so wrong was at about the halfway point where he said, the work is underway now to get better, and then didn't say a word about what that work is, and then went on to take credit for the things that went, according to him, went well last year, and there were some things that went well, and that got you the exact same number of wins it got you the year before.
Yeah.
And then he went past that and started talking about a bunch of things that don't matter to fans because they have nothing to do with winning games. You know, and I just, and we know that they are one of the biggest revenue teams in the league. We know that they're, you know, the one of the top three markets in the league. And we know that if he wants his fans to believe he's doing everything he can to compete, then he's going to have to commit to spending the way that the other top market teams are spending. And he can still be one of the richest owners in the game, which he will still be. But he made it sound like they're not going to do anything. He made it, like you pointed out, you know, you go back to the 16 team. It all came out of the farm system. Mm-hmm. He made it sound, well, that's going to happen again. Didn't happen this offseason. What happened this offseason?
And I don't know, like, I don't know that much about these prospects. I mean, we could all throw the names around, but it sure doesn't feel like this the same level. These might be good major league players that come up to the Cubs, but it sure does, you know, it feels like, and I hate to say this, it feels like Nico Hoerner. You know what I mean? Like Nico Hoerner, a good baseball player who came from your system. Like that's the, like it feels like kind of like that level. Now I will say this, and I'm going to bring in Sean Sears here because he and I have an affinity for Pete Crow Armstrong, who he did mention in there. That I will give Ricketts that as well. Like PCA, I think that guy could end up being a damn good baseball player. I mean, we'll see, but he started to get scary good towards the end of this season. So I do think that there is something there with him. You know, Swanson kind of took a step back, talked about Hoerner. Michael Bush was a revelation for sure. I don't know if he'll be able to sustain that. But Sears, what did you think? Sean Sears is like you, Hub, probably about the same level. He is a big-time, hardcore, live-and-die-with-the-Cubs Cubs fan. Something what did like you that. Think about the – what was that?
Is it something like that?
Are you losing your enthusiasm,
no,
Sears?
No. I felt similarly to Hub. It's just kind of a little frustrating, you know, just because, like, you know – you're not going to give us a detailed idea of like what you're planning on doing or saying like we're going to put money into this team, which like, you know, no owner really does. But, you know, if you're going to sit there and have that conversation or send that letter out, like maybe don't just say like, yeah, we tried hard and we're already trying harder. And, you know, maybe if we try a little bit harder this next year, we're going to win. And it's like, you know, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear you're going to either spend money or you're going to, you know, I don't know, get it the hell out of the way. Yeah, I don't know.
What is your core right now? Even like what is the core of the Cubs? Is it Ian Happ? Is Isak Paredes? Is he part of the team that wins? Swanson going to get his act back together?
Yeah,
like,
I think there is a core. First of all, I thought Swanson got treated really unfairly this year. He wasn't that bad. He wasn't an all-star again this year, which he was last year. But don't forget, he was playing hurt a fair amount of the time. You know, he got that leg screwed up. It was before even the halfway point of the season. And it's not like he had a terrible – he didn't have an all-star year like he did last year.
Right.
I think that you know, you got to be excited about Pete Crow Armstrong. You got to feel good about your first baseman, you know, Bush. And beyond that, Ian Happ is probably going to give you, well, at least one more.
He had a terrific season.
A couple more good years.
Yeah, Happ is good. Yeah.
So there is a core there, but what they need is the two stars that make them a different team to add to last year's three all-stars, you know? And so you've got to go out and get that power bat, and you probably need to go out and get a closer, you know, and spend money on those people.
Yeah, they messed that up this year.
Now,
I mean,
they may have enough that if they just add the right two guys in that area, they can be competitive. But I think to come back from last year with the exact same record this year, with spending $40 million on a new head coach, and pretend that the year was in any way successful, you can't do that.
The guys that he name-checked, too, Porter Hodge. And I get it. Like, they did, like, quietly, they made semi-names for themselves. Nate Pearson, like, he's throwing these names around. And, you know, I don't want to, like, dog these guys too much, because then it might come back and bite me if they're actually good. But it's just funny. Like, those names don't move the meter. You know what I mean? Like, that's not what Cubs baseball is right now.
I think it's possible the only thing that Ricketts is really leaning on right now is that he doesn't own the White Sox.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we're doing relativity, then you're in really good shape. We might revisit the Cubs here, but we do have to take a break and get back to the Bears and Jaguars as they play Sunday in London. And when we return, we will get a voice from Jacksonville, who has been on this radio station a couple of times. Last time I talked to Mia O'Brien is when Trevor Lawrence came to the Jaguars. So we will get an update on him and all that is the Jaguars and what the Bears are facing on Sunday. Along with Hub Arkish, I'm Mark Grody on The Score.
But Ken Lawrence get them into the end zone. Puts a man under it. Far side. He's got Thomas wide open. Thomas. Touchdown. 85 yards.
We're back with more Mark Grody and Hub Arkish on 670 The Score.
What's happening? Yeah. Jaguars won. They beat the Colts 37-34. Brian Thomas, the rookie out of LSU, ended up with five catches, 122 yards, and that 85-yarder. I was looking at some advanced stats, next-gen stats, and I think he had in the top 10 of fastest moments or runs on the field. I think he appears twice in that top 10, so they may have something there. Yeah, it is Mark Grody and Hub Arkish with you. Before the Bears, or I should say, before Chicago takes on Jacksonville in London, tune in tomorrow morning from 9 to 11. A special day and time for your local Ford dealers pregame show right here on 670 The Score, presented by Aurelio's. Join Molly, Olin Krutz, and Patrick Manley as we'll get you set for the game. Then immediately following the game on Sunday, Molly, Olin, and Manley will have instant reaction on the Great Clips postgame show presented by Sony Pictures, Wonderverse, Chicago, and TimberTech Decking and Railing. All of it can be heard on The Score and the Odyssey app. Let's go to Jacksonville. Guests join us on The Score Hotline, presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. Mia O'Brien covers the Jaguars for 1010XL in Jacksonville. Mia, long time no talk. How are you?
Hello, my long-lost friend. Hope all is well. I can't help but smile at that that phone line powered by Circa, as I know my show, Helmets and Heels, is headed out to Las Vegas to stay at Circa, do our show live from there. It'll be my first time at Stadium Swim in December when the Jags face the Raiders. But, of course, we can't put the cart before the horse. Bears and Jags coming a little bit sooner than Jags Raiders come Christmas time.
Hey, man. Well, I hope you have a good time out there. I have not yet gotten to go there, but several of our shows have, and there have been rave reviews. So I'm guessing you're going to have a great time there. But Mia, I do have to ask you, how are you, friends and family and everybody in Jacksonville, with what's been going on in terms of the hurricanes and the awful weather that has occurred? You doing okay?
Yeah, I appreciate it. You know, we're really fortunate here. We really dodged the worst of it in Northeast Florida. A couple folks in our southern counties did experience some power outages, a little bit of flooding. I'm even more happy to report that one of my good buddies from when I worked on the news side of things at First Coast News here in Jacksonville is now actually the St. Pete Bureau Chief for the Fox affiliate down there in the Tampa area. And she said today, not only does she, her apartment, she has power and water, but the expectation is all of Pinellas County will have power come Wednesday, which, considering the doomsday scenario we were expecting for the Tampa Bay area, it's obviously great news. Although, of course, sad to see what occurred at Tropicana Field, but also great to hear that Raymond James Stadium and the Bucks training facility, outside of some cosmetic issues, is doing A-okay, and that the team will hopefully be able to come back sooner than later.
Amen. That's the voice of, again, Mia O'Brien from 1010XL in Jacksonville. And we heard the highlight coming in, Jaguars getting the win over the Colts 37-34. Trevor Lawrence, 371, two TDs. Tank Bigsby, 101 yards. Brian Thomas, we talked about his big day. A couple other guys had nice games. Christian Kirk, four catches for 88 yards. It kind of seems like you guys had what happened in Jacksonville, same thing that happened to the Bears. Finally, a breakout day for the Jaguars and the offense. Is that what it's supposed to look like in Jacksonville? Like, is this something that is sustainable? And what has it been like leading up to that game?
On the offensive side of the football, it's what it's supposed to look like. Not sure Ryan Nielsen and company thought they'd be giving up 34 points, including 24 of them in the fourth quarter, when we informed Josh Hines Allen that it was indeed 24 points the Jaguars surrendered to the Colts in the fourth quarter. He looked at us dumbfounded. Ugh. He had no idea that it was that many points in one single quarter.
That's so, what you're there for. You're there to deliver the bad news, Mia, you know?
Yep. So that's going to get cleaned up, though, of course. But no, on the offensive side of the football, look, it's been like pulling teeth. But that, of course, dates back to even during, Mark, that 8-3 start for the Jaguars last year. Even when they were winning football games, they were not winning them handily. They were winning one-score games. And look, most games in the National Football League are going to be decided by one possession. And so that part's not out of the ordinary. What was that it felt like every play was disjointed, followed by another play that didn't make much sense after it. And so play calling, obviously, as you guys I'm sure are well aware, has come into question over the last 2 years, especially when the morning of opening day last year, word got out that Press Taylor, the offensive coordinator, not Doug Peterson, would be the primary play caller. It is a hot-button topic, even now after that 37-point output last week, solely because I think Jags fans want to see it back-to-back weeks. And, of course, as Doug Peterson has very pointedly noted, it's not just coaches coaching. It also has to be players playing. I would argue that through the first 4 weeks of the season, in which the Jaguars, of course, went winless this year, certainly a good load must be shouldered by the players and the lack of execution. In particular, you go to the game against Houston, which for all intents purposes, you know, 1 week prior to this offensive outburst against the Colts, Trevor Lawrence hits Brian Thomas Jr. down the sideline. He hits Christian Kirk down the sideline. Those are two scores. And it's a very, very different sentiment in Duval County after that first AFC South meeting. And so I think ultimately, for lack of a better term, Gus Bradley's cover three defense was the cure-all and has been the cure-all for Trevor Lawrence, who is 3-0 against the Colts at home in his in three seasons under Doug Peterson. I believe it's 4-0, yes, because the Jags haven't lost to the Colts at home. So it's 4-0 in his career at home against Indianapolis. He's 5-2 against them under Doug Peterson. And so he's had their number, and I think it was what this offense really needed, an opportunity to take what the defense presents you underneath, ultimately lure the secondary closer to the line of scrimmage, and then hit that deep shot like he did to Brian Thomas Jr., and then, of course, a 66-yard completion to Christian Kirk as well.
You know, Mia, it's interesting. After back-to-back 9-8 seasons and then coming into this year, a lot of people had the Jaguars as the next, you know, big thing, or the team that was really improving. And a lot of that obviously built around Trevor Lawrence. And I thought from the beginning that Trevor Lawrence was going to be the next big thing at quarterback. After his first year and a half, the last year and a half, he seems to be going in the wrong direction. I shouldn't say that. I know he's had some injury issues too. But he clearly, at this point in his career, has not yet become the franchise quarterback that they thought they were getting by using a number one pick overall on a quarterback. What is it with Trevor Lawrence that has held back his development?
Yeah, if you had asked me that, you know, a week or two ago, I think that rightfully or wrongfully so, plenty of folks were questioning the system around him. And, you know, ultimately, so many people want to dismiss the fact that he was coached by Urban Meyer and company his rookie season. And so that one gets thrown out the window. But, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice. Now a different coaching staff. Doug Peterson, the quote-unquote quarterback whisperer, Mike McCoy, a former quarterback in the National Football League, a former head coach, is the quarterback's coach. You know, all of a sudden you're looking around and saying, is it the coaching or is it the player himself? I can tell you this from, you know, my relationship working with Trevor over the last 4 years. I mean, he is A-plus human being. I have seen a different edge to him in the last few months in particular. You know, I've told a couple people that I was told by more than one person, and I witnessed it once, that he's the one person who, even after the Jaguars would run sprints during training camp, he'd stay a little bit later. He recognizes he has to move differently, even if he does have God-given ability that most other human beings do not have. I think he's recognizing that he has to do a little bit extra comparatively than what he did the year prior, because last year was only good enough to lead you to 9 wins. With that said, I think what really we need to have a dialogue when it comes to Trevor Lawrence about is, it's okay to say he can be a top 10 quarterback, but he needs a stable run game. People have completely overlooked the fact that, yes, he was a generational prospect. He was a national champion, a Heisman runner-up at Clemson. He also happened to have the ACC's all-time leading rusher in the backfield with him, a guy by the name of Travis Etienne, oh, who, by the way, is still here in Jacksonville, and the Jaguars' run game is top 5 in the National Football League, yet they're 16th in attempts this year, because not only do you have Travis Etienne, but you have the thunder of Tank Bigsby, sure, and yet this team is not actually opting for that part of its offensive skill set that could ease some of the burden on Trevor Lawrence and allow for him to play freer.
You know, we had Justin Fields here for the last 3 years until this year, and I can tell you that Justin is an A++ individual. He's a great person. He's a great teammate. He was great in the locker rooms. What he's not great at is an NFL passer. And I'm not saying he never will be. You know, there's still a little more to see. But now we come back to Herbert. I mean, is it in 4 years, have you seen the type of skill as a quarterback, throwing the football, making the right decisions, making them fast enough, reading defenses well enough, is all that there that they thought was there when they drafted him? Or has it turned out that he doesn't have some of the things they thought they were getting?
I think that he wasn't quite as ready-made right out of the box as a lot of people thought, whether that was the initial coaching staff when Trevor was drafted or even the current coaching staff, who, of course, this is their third year with him. And I think that's okay. And Doug Peterson has been very transparent about that. That, look, Trevor Lawrence turned 25 years old on Sunday. We all believe that, oh, these quarterbacks need to come in and they need to be Patrick Mahomes. Patrick Mahomes had a year to develop. No one wants to talk about that. People expect these quarterbacks to come in and read defenses as well as Aaron Rodgers and his prime. And that 8 times out of 10, with maybe, you know, C.J. Stroud as an exception and perhaps Justin Herbert, like, that doesn't happen, and I think that's okay. We've seen enough from Trevor that we've seen growth. This season in particular, one thing that obviously the team knew and Trevor knew had to be addressed was ball security. He has thrown just 2 interceptions so far this year. I think that is very noteworthy. Or is it 3? I'm doing the math in my head because he did throw one on Sunday. Either way, point being, he has not fumbled the ball. That was something that plagued him, especially down the stretch last year, which, yes, as you noted, he was hurt. But that's no excuse for how many times the ball was simply fumbled away throughout the course of a 17-game season. That has not happened. And so that speaks to a player who is able to develop, who can be coached, and who can grow. I think ultimately with Trevor, I think a lot of questions surround his ability to see the middle of the field. I've heard that from a couple different people around the National Football League. Look, I mean, if you look at the numbers that Christian Kirk and Evan Engram put up in 2022, the bulk of that was in the middle of the field. So that says to me, if he was seeing it in 2022, he should be able to see it in 2024. And so ultimately, look, it's going to be a work in progress, but I think that's okay because we do see him, for example, the Brenton Strange touchdown on Sunday, easily that was his third read. You do see him going through progressions. Maybe it's not on a consistent basis that so many thought it would be at this juncture, but we also look around the National Football League and guys like Sam Darnold, Baker Mayfield, Jared Goff having renaissances, and it says to me, while certainly we hope that that is not with another team besides the Jaguars, that there this has to be a gradual process with Trevor.
Yeah, and considering too, Mia, the as Hub and you kind of touched on it as well, the regression which has occurred with Jacksonville, as Hub said, kind of a, you know, the stylish team that was on the come and looked like they were going to be the team that you could pick because of what they had coming. And now that they have kind of taken the foot off the gas pedal, it brings me back to Doug Peterson, and I better understand, because from the outside you hear Doug Peterson could be, you know, in the hot seat, which sounds crazy because the guy won a Super Bowl in Philadelphia. He seemed to turn around the Jacksonville program to a large degree, but you know, as you mentioned, having handed over play calling, is Doug Peterson like, what does he have to do to last this season, or are they going to let it ride out to the end of the season before they decide what they would do with Doug Peterson?
Yeah, Mark, I will just tell you this. Owner Shad Khan said that this is the most talented team that he has had in Jacksonville since he bought the team 12-plus years ago. He actually said it's the most talented Jacksonville team ever, and some former players took issue with that. Point being, he's not out of line when he says it's the most talented team on paper in 12 years. That is the owner putting the coaching staff, the players, everyone involved with this franchise on notice. 9 wins is not good enough. I would be interested to see if the Jaguars got to 9 wins somehow, despite starting 1-4. If they got to 9 wins and did not make the postseason, if Doug Peterson, his services were retained. Because ultimately, I think that this is Shad Khan drawing a line in the sand and saying the expectation is higher now in Jacksonville. It's not just good enough to have a winning record. We expect postseason appearances if we are to have paid this quarterback handsomely, if we are to have invested across the board with this roster. And so, look, if you had asked me a week or two ago, especially after that Buffalo debacle on Monday Night Football, the sports books weren't lying when they had Doug Peterson as the head coach most likely to be fired first. With that said, I've had a couple conversations with people around the building in the last 2 weeks. There is this sense of this locker room is not lost. This locker room is more together than ever, contrary to what some national reports are. You need to give them time. It is simply a quarter of the season, one person told me. There's a long way to go, especially when you consider that the heart of this roster and most of the coaches were here 2 years ago when this team started 2-6. And granted, by virtue of abysmal picking in the top 4 seasons at the hands of the Houston Texans and the Indianapolis Colts, by proxy of that and the Tennessee Titans' own collapse, the Jaguars were able to make their way into the postseason. I think they recognize they can't bank on that happening this year, but they do understand that it was always going to be a tough road with the first month of the season, the way that it was laid out. The Jaguars had, I believe, I saw some stat out there. It was like only the second time since 2014 that a team has had to face 4 playoff teams from the year before in their first 4 games. It was never going to be easy. It's unfortunate because if you take away 2 or 3 plays, the Jaguars are at worst 2-2 coming out of the month of September. But unfortunately, that's how the game is decided, 1 or 2 plays. So here they found themselves 0-4. It was a necessary win last week. I will quote Ben Solak of ESPN because I mentioned it to a couple people around the program in the last few weeks. He said that it just felt like this team needs to gargle some mouthwash, spit it out, and then they'll go to who they're supposed to be. That remains to be seen, but certainly if they can stack a win on top of last week's out in London this week, I think that then they're on the path to doing just that.
I like that analogy. And I would suggest like the Listerine, no alcohol. That's the direction that I usually like to go in terms of the mouthwash.
You never know with those Florida men. Maybe they want some alcohol. I'm just kidding.
Mia, last question before I let you go. And trust me, I do not take it for granted that you agreed to come on a Friday night when you're probably just wanting to enjoy some time to yourself or out with friends. So I really appreciate you coming on. What was the best part about working with Alex Kuhn in Iowa? Was there a best part?
So here's the really sad part is that, and I don't feel bad saying this, my news operation in Iowa, unfortunately, was very stuffy. I was so afraid of breaking the rules that when the likes of Todd Brommelkamp and Alex Kuhn and Tyler Ivins would ask me to come on the radio, I was afraid I would get in trouble until I was in my final 6 months. And then I just was like, screw it. I'm going to go on like every Tuesday or Thursday with them and just pop on into the office. We actually did a joint March Madness bracket with them. And I don't know if it was Alex or Todd or whoever bought the trophy, but straight up it was taller than me and I won. And so I know they all had a lot of fun with the 5'3" trophy that was bigger than me and that photo. And of course, parading it between KGAM where I worked and KGYM, of course, where they were. So, yeah, love those guys. Had Tyler on, who, of course, was Alex's predecessor at the gym. Had him on. He's now with the Sports Animal in Knoxville. We had him on my show yesterday. And let's just say whenever anyone within the KGYM stratosphere universe, that includes Gabe Kuhn as well, whenever any one of them comes on to 1010XL, I think all my co-hosts are like, oh, God, here come the Iowa references, and have to just brace themselves for the chaos that's about to ensue.
That's hilarious. I think I told you this the last time you're on. We were talking about Iowa. I think Iowans, and I'm not just saying this, I think they're some of the, like, pound for pound, some of the nicest people in the country, people from Iowa. I don't know where, I don't know who's competing with you guys, but you're just good folk.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mark. I also would like to note that I do think that that is still true, independent of what the football operation may bring to you tomorrow at noon. I'm just kidding. Yes, love the people of Iowa, and was very blessed to have spent the time out there that I did.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, guys. Now it's time to go root for the Big Ten's other flagship program and, of course, Chicago's team.
Oh, you talk about Northwestern there? Northwestern?
Oh, that's what we got cooking here tonight. Come on now. We got some Big Ten action. My boyfriend's actually a Utah fan, so we're going to be locked in on the Utes in just a little bit.
Okay, well, I see the Wildcats are leading 7-0, but you already know that. 7-0 in the second quarter with all of the second quarter to go right now. They lead Maryland.
Hey, you know what? Fade September, Maryland, folks. There's one thing I can leave you with. Fade September, Maryland.
There it is. Gambling vice on the way up. Yeah, we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Take care, guys. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Mia.
Yep. Mia O'Brien from Jacksonville. Again, she covers the Jaguars for 1010XL in Jacksonville. If you want more great insight like that, follow her on X. She is at Mia O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N, TV. And Alex Kuhn, one of our fine producers here, he worked with her in Iowa. So that's why that talk came up. It's Mark Grody and Hub Arkish on The Score.
We're back with more Mark Grody and Hub Arkish on 670 The Score.
He's going to be going to Honolulu every year for a long time.
First down, Jacksonville. They trail 13-0. The screen is intercepted. Big Keith Traylor. Look at him rumble. 40, 50. Watch out. The earth is shaking. He's at the 30. He's at the 20. He won't give it up. Oh, my.
Well, I know Chicago already has a refrigerator. Maybe they got room for an ice maker. Why, first of all, watch the athleticism, the one-handed stab by Keith Traylor. And now it's all instinct. He's picking him up. He's laying him down.
71 yards. It must look like 7,100 yards.
Oh, can punt returner be next for Keith Traylor?
Look out, refrigerator. You got to be worried now.
Oh, look at him cover up the ball, too. He puts both hands on it like an Ohio State fullback.
That's a moment you just have to know if you follow the Bears. I don't care how old you are. You have to know that in January of 2002, the Bears beat the Jacksonville Jaguars 33-13, and Keith Traylor moved the earth on it wasn't a pick six. He eventually did get taken down to the ground.
He's trying to hand the ball off at the end because he knows he's getting tackled.
So good. I believe that was Dick Enberg and Dan Dierdorf on the call. You remember that, Hub? You remember that great moment with Keith Traylor?
Right, I remember there? The Traylor moment. I can't remember who was calling the game.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I'm just going off
For
of
all
what...
I know, I could have been on the sidelines. I don't remember.
Yeah, no, you've covered a lot of games, Hub. I always like to look at box scores and these things. The quarterback of the Jaguars then was a classic. Mark Brunell, 19 of 36, 189 yards in that game. He was picked off three times in that game. A few Bears statistics, because I know that we're getting close to the top of the hour, and we're going to bring in Trey Wingo to talk more Bears and more NFL here in just a second. But that was Jim Miller. That was the Jim Miller era. 19 of 28, 159 yards, and a touchdown. Marty Booker. You know, it's funny. Like, Marty Booker's name comes up right after Jim Miller because I don't remember this. Apparently, he threw a pass in that game. He was 0 for 1 as a quarterback was Marty Booker. The A-Train, Anthony Thomas, 33 carries for 160 yards. That's a 4.8 yards per carry. He had a touchdown as well. Was it a 34-yarder? Because it says he had a long of 34 as well. Leon Dam Johnson was the fullback in that game. Remember fullbacks, everybody? And just firing through a few of these names, too, the receivers. Dwayne Bates, who was a Northwestern guy, had 4 catches for 50 yards that day. Marty Booker, 6 catches, 37 yards. Ahmad Merritt, 2 catches, 20 yards. David Terrell, we the Bears, baby. 2 catches, 17 yards. James Allen was a Bear. Remember, he was the starting running back that year until the A-Train took over at some point in time. Anthony Thomas did have a catch for 11 yards as well. So, and just a few other names here. They had got Michael Green, Warwick Dam Holdman. I loved him. R.W. McCorders, who had a terrific year as well. Tony Parrish, Mike Brown, Dustin Lyman, Todd McMillan, Erlacher, Alfonso Boone, Keith Traylor, Philip Daniels, Greg Jones, Roosevelt Colvin, Ted Washington. He was the other biggin along with Keith Traylor on that team. Joe Tafoya, and Ahmad Merritt gets named again because he popped up in one of the defensive statistics as well, as he was a special teams guy. So, like to go down memory lane, very memorable Bears-Jacksonville game.
You know, in the unfortunate Bears quarterback history.
Yeah.
Jim Miller is one of my favorite Bears quarterbacks of all time.
As a player or a person, or what
more,
do you mean?
Like, more as a person than a player, because he's just a great human being.
He had a 400-yard game with the Bears.
Well, and I was also nobody saw him coming. He was one of the few who was not brought in to be the starter. He earned the position. He took the position, and he played it well for him for a few years.
Yeah, he was in Pittsburgh. He was back up to, I think he backed up Cordell Stewart, or was he backing up Cordell Stewart when Cordell Stewart came to the Bears? I got to get my facts straight on that. But, you know, Jim Miller, in the relative, like, he's not one of those guys that you put on the list when we go through all the Bears quarterbacks. Like, he is not one that you say was a bust or bad. Like, when Jim Miller was given opportunities, he was pretty good. Unfortunately, he was crushed in 2001 by Hugh Douglas and the Philadelphia Eagles, if you remember that game, where basically he was just crushed.
I'm just forgetting now, but he wasn't the quarterback of the 06 Super Bowl team, was he?
No, that was Mitch Trubisky the quarterback of that team. But Jim Miller was kind of meddled in that era, but we don't want to go down quarterback lane because I have to take a break right now because we're going to bring in Trey Wingo, and we're late. He's Hub Arkish. I'm Mark Grody. This is The Score.